Then, going on, he presently met a ragged man and exchanged clothes with him, and so, having divested himself of all worldly entanglements, he was free to pursue his search after wisdom. He made his way southward to a resort of hermits and teachers in a hilly spur running into Bengal northward from the Vindhya Mountains, close to the town of Rajgir. There a number of wise men lived in a warren of caves, going into the town for their simple supplies, and imparting their knowledge by word of mouth to such as cared to come to them. This instruction must have been very much in the style of the Socratic discussions that were going on in Athens a couple of centuries later. Gautama became versed in all the metaphysics of his age, but his acute intelligence was dissatisfied with the solutions offered him. The Indian mind has always been disposed to believe that power and knowledge may be obtained by extreme asceticism, by fasting, sleeplessness, and self-torment. And these ideas Gautama now put to the test. He betook himself with 5 disciple companions to the jungle in a gorge in the Vindhya Mountains, and there he gave himself up to fasting and terrible penances. His fame spread like the sound of a great bell hung in the canopy of the skies. But it brought him no sense of truth achieved. One day he was walking up and down, trying to think in spite of his enfeebled state. Suddenly he staggered and fell unconscious. When he recovered, the preposterousness of these semi-magic ways of attempting wisdom was plain to him. He amazed and horrified his 5 companions by demanding ordinary food and refusing to continue his self-mortifications. He had realized that whatever truth a man may reach is reached best by a nourished brain in a healthy body. Such a conception was absolutely foreign to the ideas of the land and age. His disciples deserted him and went off in a melancholy state to Benares. The boom of the great bell ceased. Gautama, the wonderful, had fallen. For a time, Gautama wandered alone, the loneliest figure in history, battling for light. When the mind grapples with a great and intricate problem, it makes its advances, it secures its positions step by step, with but little realization of the gains it has made, until suddenly, with an effect of abrupt illumination, it realizes its victory. So it would seem it happened to Gautama. He had seated himself under a great tree by the side of a river to eat when this sense of clear vision came to him. It seemed to him that he saw life plain. He is said to have sat all day and all night in profound thought, and then he rose up to impart his vision to the world. Second, such is the plain story of Gautama as we gather it from a comparison of early writings. But common men must have their cheap marvels and wonders. It's nothing to them that this little planet should at last produce upon its surface a man thinking of the past and the future and the essential nature of existence. And so we must have this sort of thing by some worthy Pali scribe making the most of it. When the conflict began between the Savior of the world and the Prince of Evil, 1,000 appalling meteors fell, rivers flowed back towards their sources, peaks and lofty mountains, where countless trees had grown for ages, rolled crumbling to the earth, the sun enveloped itself in awful darkness, and a host of headless spirits filled the air. Of which phenomena history has preserved no authentication. Instead, we have only the figure of a lonely man walking towards Benares. Extraordinary attention has been given to the tree under which Gautama had this sense of mental clarity. It was a tree of the fig genus, and from the first it was treated with peculiar veneration. It was called the bow tree. It's long since perished, but close at hand lives another great tree which may be its descendant. And in Ceylon there grows to this day a tree, the oldest historical tree in the world, which we know certainly to have been planted as a cutting from the bow tree in the year 245 BC. From that time to this, it's been carefully tended and watered. Its great branches are supported by pillars, and the earth has been terraced up about it so that it has been able to put out fresh roots continually. It helps us to realize the shortness of all human history to see so many generations spanned by the endurance of one single tree. Gautama's disciples, unhappily, have cared more for the preservation of his tree than of his thought, which from the first they misconceived and distorted. At Benares, Gautama sought out his five pupils who were still leading the ascetic life. There's an account of their hesitation to receive him when they saw him approaching. He was a backslider. But there was some power of personality in him that prevailed over their coldness, and he made them listen to his new convictions. For 5 days the discussion was carried on. When he had at last convinced them that he was now enlightened, they hailed him as the Buddha. There was already in those days a belief in India that at long intervals wisdom returned to the earth and was revealed to mankind through a chosen person known as the Buddha. According to Indian belief, there have been many such Buddhas. Gautama Buddha is only the latest one of a series. But it's doubtful if he himself accepted that title or recognized that theory. In his discourses, he never called himself the Buddha. He and his recovered disciples then formed a sort of academy in the deer park at Benares. They made themselves huts, and accumulated other followers to the number of 70 or more. In the rainy season they remained in discourse at this settlement, and during the dry weather they dispersed about the country, each giving his version of the new teachings. All their teaching was done, it would seem, by word of mouth. There was probably no writing yet in India at all. We must remember that in the time of Buddha it's doubtful if even the Iliad had been committed to writing. Probably the Mediterranean alphabet, which is the basis of most Indian scripts, hadn't yet reached India. The master, therefore, worked out and composed pithy and brief verses, aphorisms, and lists of points, and these were expanded in the discourse of his disciples. It greatly helped them to have these points and aphorisms numbered. The modern mind is apt to be impatient of the tendency of Indian thought to a numerical statement of things, the eightfold path, the four truths, and so on, but this enumeration was a mnemonic necessity in an undocumented world. Third, the fundamental teaching of Gautama, as it's now being made plain to us by the study of original sources, is clear and simple, and in the closest harmony with modern ideas. It's beyond all dispute the achievement of one of the most penetrating intelligences the world has ever known. We have what are almost certainly the authentic heads of his discourse to the five disciples, which embodies his essential doctrine. All the miseries and discontents of life he traces to insatiable selfishness. Suffering, he teaches, is due to the craving individuality, to the torment of greedy desire. Until a man has overcome every sort of personal craving, his life is trouble and his end sorrow. There are three principal forms the craving of life takes, and all are evil. The first is the desire to gratify the senses, sensuousness. The second is the desire for personal immortality. The third is the desire for prosperity, worldliness. All these must be overcome, that's to say, a man must no longer be living for himself before life can become serene. But when they are indeed overcome, and no longer rule a man's life, when the first personal pronoun has vanished from his private thoughts, then he has reached the higher wisdom, nirvana, serenity of soul. For nirvana doesn't mean, as many people wrongly believe, extinction, but the extinction of the futile personal aims that necessarily make life base or pitiful or dreadful. Now here, surely, we have the completest analysis of the problem of the soul's peace. Every religion that's worth the name, every philosophy, warns us to lose ourselves in something greater than ourselves. Whosoever would save his life shall lose it. There is exactly the same lesson. The teaching of history, as we are unfolding it in this book, is strictly in accordance with this teaching of Buddha.